We're looking this morning at Psalm 126. And I've titled my sermon, "It Was Like a Dream." One of the big problems the church faces, that Christian people face, is having the mindset of the world about us. The world seeks to squeeze us into its mould. And one of the dangers that we face is having a tourist mindset. Christian life, both in the scriptures and in Christian literature generally, is often pictured as a journey. We're on a journey to God and to glory. But we're not on a journey as tourists. And too many of us understand the Christian life as a visit to an interesting site when we have adequate leisure. A weekly trip to church, an occasional visit to a special service, an annual weekend away at camp. But we're not tourists, we're pilgrims. Tourists, you see, are sightseers. And they go on their journey to enjoy it and to see the sights and to have a good time. We don't go on our journey to see the sights and have fun. Although on the journey there are sights we see and there are times of great joy. But that's not the purpose of our journey. We don't measure the success of our journey by how much fun we've had or how many sights we've seen. Our journey, you see, has a goal. And the important thing is not that we see interesting sights on the way, but that we reach our goal. How much fun we have or how many sights we see is totally irrelevant. All that matters is that we reach our goal. And our goal is seeing and sharing the glory of God. When I was choosing a title for this sermon, one of the titles I thought of was "Counsel for Life's Journey." Because what we have in Psalm 126 is counsel, advice for pilgrims on a journey. It's called a Song of Ascents. It's one of a number of psalms in this section of the Psalter which are called Songs of Ascent, beginning with Psalm 120. It's a song of ascent. It was a song that pilgrims sang as they ascended to Jerusalem for a holy festival, such as Passover or Pentecost or Yom Kippur. And as they made their way from Israel, across Judah, towards Jerusalem, they would sing these psalms, which is why they're called songs of ascent. And so this is a pilgrim song, and it contains advice for pilgrims. What I want to do is go through it quickly and see what it says and what it means, so that we understand it. And then I want to draw three lessons from it for us today in this second decade of the 21st century. You'll notice that it consists of six verses, and these six verses have two stanzas, each of three verses. Each stanza begins with the same Hebrew phrase, or the same Hebrew word. It's Shavuot. In the King James Version, it's translated, turned again the captivity. In verse 1, and then in verse 4, turn again our captivity. More literally, Shavuot means simply restore our fortunes. There was a time when you restored our fortunes, he says in verse 1. Restore our fortunes again, O Lord, he says in verse 4. So the psalm looks back to the past, to a time when God restored the fortunes of the nation, or turned again its captivity, to use the expression in the King James Version. The nation had fallen on bad times, but then the Lord intervened and restored its fortunes. And it seems the nation has again fallen on bad times. And the prayer is that the Lord would do again what he did in the past and restore the nation's fortunes or return again its captivity. It says, when the Lord turned again the captivity of Zion, we were like them that dream. It was like a dream. We had to pinch ourselves. Is this really happening? We all know what it is to have a bad dream and wake up and be very thankful that's not true. And I trust we know what it is too, to have a lovely dream and wake up and be so disappointed that it was just a dream. Well, here was something happening that was so wonderful. It seemed too good to be true. It seemed that God had forsaken us and we'd fallen on such hard times. It may well be that it's looking back to the time of the captivity in Babylon. That may well be the time it's looking back to, when the leaders of the nation and many of the people were taken as captives to Babylon, and thinking, well, that's the end. And then, what a surprise when Cyrus issued his decree and they could go back those decades later and rebuild their city and their temple and their nation. The Lord restored the captivity of Zion. What an amazing thing. It was so wonderful. We were wondering, are we dreaming? Is this really happening to us? Is God really answering our prayers? Is he really fulfilling his promises? Is it now? Am I living in the generation that's witnessing this good thing? So the psalmist looks back to some time in the past when God's people had fallen on hard times, when the obstacles facing them seemed immovable and their salvation seemed impossible. Whether it was siege or captivity or some other disaster such as famine or plague, or simply spiritual and moral declension such as we see in our own nation in our day, even at the highest levels. The psalmist refers to some time in the past when the people had gone through great difficulties and when deliverance seemed against all odds. Yet against all odds, the Lord delivered them and restored them. And it was not their doing, you notice. When the Lord turned again the captivity of Zion, this was a sovereign work of God. This was something they could never have done themselves. The Lord did it for them and to them. And he says, then our mouth was filled with laughter, our tongues with shouts of joy. Then they said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us. Notice the two thens there in verse 2. Then our mouth was filled with laughter. Then they said among the nations. He says, as for our mouth, when the Lord did that, we were laughing and we were singing. But it wasn't only our mouths that were opened by what the Lord had done. The nations around witnessed it and saw what God did for his people. And they were talking, saying, the Lord has done great things for us. In Hebrew, Yahweh. Jehovah has done great things for us. And it's been so in the history of the church. There have been times when the church has fallen on hard times. Wickedness has increased and the church has gone into decline, both numerically and spiritually. And then God has poured out his Spirit and sent revival, and the church is awakened out of its slumbers and the joy returns. And then the world around notices what's happening and starts talking about what God is doing among the Christians. That's the history of the church. So wonderful, so unexpected, so overwhelming was this act of God that even the nations, even the Gentiles, even the pagans, even the unbelievers were compelled to acknowledge the hand of God. There was just no other explanation for it. The Lord has done great things for them, the Gentiles were saying. And the Jews echo it. The Lord has done great things for us. All peoples, Jews and Gentiles, join in proclaiming the greatness and goodness of God. And it says, we are glad, or we are filled with joy. We are one happy people, Eugene Peterson translates it. Not only were they glad back then, you notice, but they are still glad now. They look back and remember what God had done, and though they've fallen on hard times again, they don't say we were glad. They say, we are glad. We're still thankful. We're still rejoicing in what God did for us so long ago. But then, having looked back in verses 1 to 3, in verses 4 to 6, the psalmist looks forward. See? And he begins by praying. In verse 4, turn again our captivity, O Lord. Or it could be translated, restore our fortunes, O Lord. God is the same today as he was then. What he has done in the past, he can do again. We can't twist his arm. We can't force his hand. But we can plead with him, and he's a God who works in answer to prayer. It says, as the streams in the south, literally in the Hebrew it says the streams in the Negev. Negev or Negev is a Hebrew word and it means dry or parched. It is the name given to the southern region of Judah, the Negev Desert, extending down towards the Sinai Peninsula. And usually the gullies of the Negev are bone dry. But when the rains come, these dry gullies are transformed in minutes into torrents of rushing water. And the arid desert is transformed in days into flowers. That is what God does for a people when he pours out his Spirit. Lord, we've fallen on dry times. We're going through a drought. We're parched. Pour out your Spirit. Bring life again to this dying church. And then in verses 5 and 6, he that goeth forth and weepeth, bearing precious seed, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bearing his sheaves with him. To see this picture clearly, we must enter into the world of the subsistence farmer. Remember, in ancient times, and still in many parts of the world, when they needed food, they couldn't go to the supermarket and buy it. Food was a problem. Food was the number one problem, which is why give us this day our daily bread is so important in the Lord's Prayer. They grew their own food. And when they harvested it, they put aside most of it for the family to eat over the next 12 months for the next harvest. And they put some aside as seed grain that they would go out and sow next year. And when the rains come, they head out and start broadcasting their seed, sowing their seed. But now the rains are not coming. It's autumn has gone and there's been no autumn rains and now we're into winter. And there's no winter rains. So what does the farmer do? He goes out and he sows his seed. He sows his seed. Hoping and praying that God will send rain and that the seeds will sprout and bear more seed. But he does it weeping because he's not sure whether the rain's going to come or not. And if the rain doesn't come, by the time next autumn comes, by the time summer comes around and harvest time comes around, last year's crop will be consumed and they'll be left with nothing. And no food means his kids perish. And he and his wife with them. And so he goes out sowing in tears. It's an anxious time. But the promise is, you see, he that goeth forth and weeping, bearing precious seed, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him. And again, it's a picture of the fortunes of God's people. Let's be honest, the church in our time, in this land, has fallen on hard times. Numbers of Christians as a proportion of the population is in steady decline. Many churches have gone off after false teachings, thinking that they can twist God's arm. Others have grown very sleepy, dormant. And around us, misery increases in the breakdown of marriages, and drug addiction, and alcohol addiction, and a host of other problems. We go on praying, and preaching, and witnessing, and working. But we wonder, is it going to be worth it? Will there be any fruit for this labour? Well, the promise is that God will do again what he did in the past. We are still to sow the seed. We can't make it grow. So we are to pray as the Israelites prayed of old. Turn again our captivity, O Lord. Restore again our fortunes, O Lord. Do again in our day what you did in days gone by. Revive your work in our generation. So there's the message of the psalm. There's a looking back to what God has done in the past, and there's a looking forward and an urgent praying for God to do it again in the future, even in our time. Now, what can we learn from this? Well, I mentioned that we're pilgrims on a journey. And we see in this psalm three things about pilgrims. Three marks of a pilgrim. First of all, pilgrims are joyful people. The land has fallen on hard times, but there's still that strong note of joy through this psalm. We were like them that dream. Our mouth was filled with laughter, our tongue with singing. They that sow in tears shall reap in joy. They shall come again with rejoicing. And we are glad. See that note of joy? It's right through the psalm. Now, you and I, most of us, are Presbyterians. Presbyterians are noted for being not joyful, but doer. Ellen Glasgow, in her autobiography, tells of her father, who was a Presbyterian elder, full of rectitude and rigid in duty. She wrote, "He was entirely unselfish, and his whole long life he never committed a pleasure." Peter Jay, in a political column in the Baltimore Sun some years ago, described the sober intensity and personal austerities of a certain politician, and then threw in this line, "He dresses like a Presbyterian." When people want to use a word to describe those who lack joy, those who are overly serious, sometimes the word they use is Presbyterian, sometimes it's Calvinist. More or less synonymous. Brothers and sisters, we're to be a joyful people. Though the psalm was clearly written in a time when God's people were going through deep waters, the dominant note is one of joy. And their rejoicing was not only in the past, it's also in the present. We are glad. We're to be a rejoicing people. We're on a journey, and at times it's difficult. And the going is hard. And the land about us is dry. And we're hot. And we've got blisters on our feet. And we're tired. and our clothes are soaked with sweat. But we are to be joyful because we have something towards which we're heading. It's a journey that will be worthwhile. That's why you see Paul writing in prison to the young Christian church in Philippi with chains around his ankles. And not sure whether he will be executed or not, says, Christ is proclaimed and I rejoice. Yes, I will rejoice. I'm determined to rejoice. Everything looks bad, but Christ is being proclaimed. I've now got an opportunity to proclaim Christ here in the prison where he wouldn't otherwise be heard. And so I rejoice. And he urges the Philippians, rejoice in the Lord always. And again I will say, rejoice. And Peter writes to Christians also undergoing persecution and suffering for their faith. He says, you rejoice. You know, it's not even commanding them. He's noting. He says, you rejoice with a joy inexpressible and full of glory. I think the King James Version has a joy unspeakable. A joy so great you can't put it into words. Pilgrims are joyful people. And it's that that gives them their strength. The joy of the Lord is our strength. We're to be joyful. We're to think on those things that are good and beautiful and lovely and true and right, that we will rejoice. And then secondly, pilgrims are hopeful people. They're marked by hope. In the early 1940s, a successful Jewish psychiatrist, then a resident of Austria, was herded into a train with 1,500 other people and sent off to a Nazi prison camp. For 3 grim years, prisoner number 119104 lived in daily horror, digging trenches within the shadow of some of the giant furnaces that claimed the lives of 6 million of his fellow Jews during World War II. Following his liberation, the psychiatrist, whose name was Viktor Frankl, wrote a book about his experience. He gave the book the title Man's Search for Meaning. Because as a psychiatrist, he made the point while in this concentration camp of observing carefully his fellow prisoners. And he noted this, that in the hardships that they endured and the great suffering and deprivation that they went through, it wasn't those who were physically fittest and strongest who survived, but those who had what he called faith in the future. The biblical word is hope. They had something to look forward to. And he said that in a sense it didn't matter what their thing they were looking forward to was. In his case, he was looking forward to writing this book. In other cases, they were looking forward to meeting again with their family. He said, if the hope died, they died. And he gives striking illustrations of it, which we don't have time to talk about this morning. We are a people of hope. That's why we're called pilgrims. We have a hope. That hope is that we see God in his glory and that we share that glory, the glory of God. That's why we're here, to glorify God, not just now, but always. And we're not there yet. Our glorification is still future. And that's everything we do, and that is towards that end. That's our reason for being. That's our reason for living. That's our reason for going on in the journey. That great and glorious hope that awaits us. We're a hopeful people. And it's that that sustains us. The psalmist had a hope, you see. He wasn't just one who looked back to the great days of the past and then bemoaned the evil days of the present. He looked to God's future work also. The Apostle Paul writes, "We rejoice in the hope of the glory of God." In Romans 5:2, in Galatians 5:5, we eagerly wait for the hope of righteousness. In Hebrews 6:19, we have this hope as a sure and steadfast anchor for the soul. And memory begets hope. As we look back to the past and remember what God has done in our lives and in the life of his church, which is one reason that reading Christian history is so encouraging in the Christian life. We see what God has done in the past, and that memory begets hope. God's grace in the past and his goodness in the past is the promise of his grace and his goodness in the future. There are advantages, you know. There are blessings in growing old. There are blessings in being young too. But there are blessings in growing old. And one of those blessings is we've had experience of God and his goodness. And we can look back and remember what he has done for us and prayers he has answered for us. And when we go through difficult times now, that memory begets hope that what he has done before he can and will do again. So pilgrims are hopeful people. And then thirdly, pilgrims are persevering. Our hope can be long awaited and hard won. It requires faithfulness, it requires diligence, it requires perseverance. Those are three vital qualities of a Christian: faithfulness, diligence, perseverance. And pilgrims are persevering people. They don't give up. They might get downhearted, but they don't despair. They carry on. God has done it before. We trust him and we pray that he will do it again. But until then, what is our role? Our role is simply to go on doing what God tells us to do, isn't it? Whether we see fruit for the labour now or not, there will be fruit in due season. Let us not grow weary in doing good, Paul wrote to the Galatians, for in due season we will reap if we do not give up. Let us not grow weary in doing good, for in due season we will reap. But there's a condition: if we do not give up. Lord, I've been at this so long, and I see so little fruit for my labour. We've been at it so long, and we fail to see you doing anything. Carry on. Don't give up. The promise is we will reap. As the Apostle Peter said, see how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until it receives the early and later rains. Our job is simply to sow the seed. We sow it by praying and preaching. I use the word preaching in the widest sense, sharing the gospel by any means the Lord gives us. Praying and preaching, preaching and praying, sowing the seed, broadcasting it as widely as we can. And in due season, we shall reap if we do not give up. So we do not despair. We do not lose heart. We do not give up. We labour on. Joyfully and hopefully, we labour on. And that's our closing hymn. It's hymn number 580 in your hymnals. Go labour on, spend and be spent, thy joy to do the Father's will. It is the way the Master went. Should not the servant tread it still? We'll not be singing the tune in the hymnal. We'll be singing it to the tune, the better known tune, I think, of Pentecost. Go labour on.